Today we're beginning here on the top of Tzadik Gimel with Aleph, two lines down. The Gemara here is continuing its discussion with regards to the machlok between Rav and Shmuel, whether we go hochim achar harov b'mamon. Do we allow majority to rule with regards to monetary matters? Shmuel says that rov has no impact with regards to dine mamon, whereas Rav says rov is koveya. So Gemara is going to continue to try to bring proofs to either side or question either side. Tashma. So we have in Baba Kama, Shor shenagachet hapara, you have an ox that gored a cow, v'nimtza ubra b'tzida, and now we found that the cow has miscarried, v'eini yadua, and we don't know, imad shelo nakcha yelda, was it before the goring that she miscarried, o im mishen nakcha yelda, or was it after the goring that she miscarried? Therefore, mishalei chatzi nezek lepara. As far as the para is concerned, we're talking about a short tam, who pays chatzi nezek. So with regards to the goring of the para, there is no doubt that the short damaged or injured the animal, and therefore you'd pay chatzi nezek. Revia the vlad, with regards to the miscarried fetus, over there you pay a quarter of the damage, which is following the position of sumchus. Sumchus says, mamona mutal b'safek chokim. So here we're uncertain as to whether the cause of the miscarriage was the goring, and therefore he would be responsible for the entire chatzi nezek, or was the miscarriage independent of the goring? It happened before the animal was gored, and he would be chayav nothing. So if you take zero and a chetzi, half of that would be a revia, would be a quarter, and that would be the responsibility of the party based on the position of sumchus. Now, what the Rashbam points out over here is, it's clear that Beit Din doesn't know what happened. We don't have any witnesses as to what happened. The only question is, were the litigants aware of what happened? That is subject to a machloket of the Amoraim in the position of Sumchus. When Sumchus says, Maimona mutal b'safek chokim, how far does that go? Is that even afilu b'bari or bari? Is that even in a case where both litigants make definitive claims, mean that the litigants know what happened, but nobody else knows? Or is Sumchus' position only true when it's a Shema and Shema, where nobody knows any of the information? This goes back to what the Rishbam mentioned yesterday, the idea that Sumchus' din only applies when there is a Safek that exists, and it pre-exists the case, meaning that the Safek exists independent of the litigant showing up in court, because we don't have information, we lack the information. If we have facts, and now we're trying to make a determination, over there, the Rashbam says that Sumchus does not apply because that's not Mamona Mutalba Safek. We know all the facts. Then it's a question of law. Question of law, we don't say Mamona Mutalba Safek is Chokim. When it's a question about the facts, then we say Mamona Mutalba Safek Chokim. So that's why the Rashbam is pointing out over here, Ve'ein Yadua LeBeitim, V'lo Yedim Yodim, Avalheim Yodim. But the litigants do know, and he's basing it on the position of Rabba Bar Rav Huna, the beginning of Baba Metzia, who says that Sumchus applies even Be Bari Ubari. There is obviously a dissenting opinion who says that it only applies when it is a Shema. So the question is, what was the proximate cause for the miscarriage over here? Was it that the animal was gored, and as part of the goring, it damaged the para, but also caused her to miscarry? Or was the miscarriage completely independent of the goring? Ramai, why should that be the case? Lema halech achar rov parot. According to Rav, who says that we follow the rove, why should this be the outcome? We should follow the rove in this instance. V'rov parot mit abrot v'yoldot. And most parot who are pregnant carry to full term and give birth to a viable baby, a viable calf. The fact that this animal miscarried is unusual. V'avadai machmat negicha hipila. And therefore, it seems that the proximate cause of the miscarriage here must be the goring, because otherwise it would have carried to full term. So according to Rav, who says that rove or majority should govern, when you have a statistical majority, which says that in most instances, or the probabilities in these cases are, that the cow will carry to full term, all of a sudden we find a miscarriage here, it likely was caused by some outside stimuli. If that's the case, then it's more likely that the nikicha caused the problem than that it happened on an independent basis. So why should you only be paying a quarter over here? You should be paying a half. We should assume that the reason for the miscarriage was the fact that it was gored. It says, Hotam mishum desvekalan deika de meimar mikama ata umibiututa hipilo. The difference there might be that even if it happened because of the goring, There are two ways that could have happened because of the goring. The animal could have approached from the front, which means that the ox was coming to gore the cow from the front, and the cow was aware of the fact that it was about to be gored, and therefore it's frightened. That fright might have caused a miscarriage. Or the other possibility is that it gored it from behind. It was never aware of it. It was about to get hit. And then it got gored from behind. The impact of the goring from behind is what caused the miscarriage. Now you're in a situation in which the facts of the case are completely uncertain as to how the miscarriage happened and how the goring happened. So the goring happened from a head-on collision, and therefore there was a fear factor that preceded the actual physical goring, and that caused the miscarriage. Or was it a goring from behind in which there was no fear factor, it was all about the impact, and that would have been the cause of the miscarriage? Since we don't know, it's mamona mutava safek, v'chol mamona mutava safek chokim. So that's a way to solve the problem. The Rashbam explains what's the difference between whether the goring caused the miscarriage or the fear caused the miscarriage. The answer is the same thing by Adam HaMazik. By Adam HaMazik, a person who does damage, there's a difference between if they do damage, hezek b'yishirut, direct damage, versus if they do hezek, derech grama. They do it by causation or causal impact. By grama, grama b'nizikin is patur. So even by an individual, if you caused someone to fear, and then something is precipitated by that fear, you will not be held responsible for it, at least b'dinei adam. You can't go to court and then extract money from them for the damages, because they were only grama. They only caused the problem. They didn't directly impact the individual. So to over here, what the Rashbam says is, certainly by a behema that does grama or causes the problem, the owner of the animal is not going to be chayav for that. So the difference between the impact of the goring causing the miscarriage and the fear of the goring causing the miscarriage is the difference between nezek and grama. One is direct damage, and therefore you're going to be responsible for it. Fear is a grama benizikin, and grama benizikin is patur. That's the way the Rashbam explains it. Other than the Balei Tosafot point out, well, wait a minute, you still have in this situation that rove cows carried a full term, and now you have this safek about whether it was from the front, from the back, if the fear caused it or it didn't cause it. But nevertheless, if you put together different pieces here, you still have the rove that cows carried a full term, and therefore there should still be an obligation here. So what the Balei Tosafot suggests over here is, v'samuch mi'uta d'mipilot, you take the mi'ut, the minority of cows that don't carry the full term, l'mi'ut d'mipituta hepila. Also, you put that together with the fact that a minority of cows will miscarry because of fear. V'itra la ruba, and that will undermine the rove. So, as opposed to the Rashbam, who seems to view this as a 50-50 shot, which is that either it got gored from behind and that was a physical impact versus gored from the front, which was a fear factor. And if there was a fear factor, we're just going to assume it miscarried because of the fear factor. The Balei Tosafot say, wait a minute, even if the animal was afraid, doesn't mean it always miscarries. There's still a majority of cows that even after they have been in fear, they still will not miscarry the fetus. So what the Balei Tosafot say is you've got to take together the two minorities, or the two miyutin here. You have a miyut, you have a minority which will not carry the full term. You have a minority who will be impacted by the fear. You add those together, they start to now eat away at the rove. They are undermining that majority of cows that reach full term. And so because of that, you've now changed the dynamic of rove. Rove works, and again, rove could be anywhere from 51% to 91%. There are different types of roves that you have out of there. So if you have a majority, and then you start to undermine it by finding possibilities where the rove would not be true, then we don't say the rove anymore is governing. So the statistical probability will not be impactful here because we're finding enough possibilities by which the statistical probability would say that maybe it's not true. And that is the fact that some cows just miscarry. Then there are some cows that, from fear, miscarry. So I have enough exceptions to the rove here that makes it that the rove will not govern. So that's the way that the Balei Tosafot explain it. in order to understand why the rove just disappears. It doesn't disappear, it's just been weakened by the fact that we have too many other possibilities that are available at this point. So now, in terms of getting rid of the problem of rove, for Rav now, we say the rove isn't kovei over here because we've undermined the rove according to the Balei Tosafot. According to the Rashbam, we've set up a case where rove is no longer relevant because we know that there's another possibility of the animal miscarrying, not just from the fact that it was gored, and that is the fear factor, which he would be patur. So now, given that, the rove isn't meaningful here, and that's why it's not a question on Rav. As far as Shmuel is concerned, even Shmuel might agree over here that the din is like sumchus, that mamona mutal b'safek is chokim, even though in other instances, like the case of mocher shor de chavero, v'nimtza nakhan, where Shmuel says over there, amotzi mi chavero, alav haraya, because that's different, as the Rashbam pointed out. This is a question about the facts. There, Shmuel will agree that Sumchus's din applies. By the case before, it was a question of what is the law over there. The facts are clear. There was a sale that took place. The question is, what was the intent of the parties? What was the nature of the sale? Or how do people sell animals in this case? That's a question of the Beitin to determine. Over there, he'll say, Motzi mechaber olav haraya. So the Rashbam just reiterates what he had said before, that in certain cases, Sumchus's din will be applicable. In other cases, Sumchus's din will not be applicable. And that's what he differentiated before between the case that we brought that started this machloket and now this case, but as well as our other cases or instances where we paskin like Sumchus. Let us suggest the machloket Rav and Shmuel is mirrored by a machloket Tanaim that we see. Shor Shaya Ru'eh, you have an ox that is grazing. Benimsa shor harug bitzido. And right next to it on the ground is a dead shor. Afopi shezeh minugach, even though the shor that is laying dead there was gored, v'zeh muad ligach, and the shor that's next to him has already been determined to be a goring shor, he is a muad l'negicha, or zeh minushach, the shor on the floor is bitten, v'zeh muad lishoch, and this shore that's next to it already has been determined or has a repeat offender in terms of biting other shvarim. Ein omrim, we don't conclude from that, biyadua shezeh nakcho v'zeh nashcho. We don't say that the conclusion for sure is the animal standing next to it is the one that killed it. Rabbi Acha omer, the other hand, Rabbi Acha believes, gamalo cher ben agmalim. If you have a gamal, now here, the way the Rashbam brings the interpretation, he says that it's based on Rashi's explanation of the word ocher. Gamal ocher means a camel that is in heat, or a camel that is mounting other animals. So now it's running around ben agmalim. Gamal harug bitzido. We find a dead camel in the flock right next to it. Biadua shezerago. You know for sure that the camel that is in heat and that is going wild is the one that killed it. Or in essence, what Rabbi Acha says is, the overwhelming circumstantial evidence leads us to believe that the killer of the gamal is the one that is acting out of line, the one who's acting wild. The other possible interpretation of the word ocher over here is the word nocher, which means that it is braying or it's wild, it's making lots of sounds. It is acting in a manner that would be indicative of circumstantial evidence that it was the perpetrator of the killing over here. So here you have a machloket between the Tanna Kamma and Rabbi Acha as to whether we say the circumstantial evidence over here, whether it governs or not. Tanna Kamma says, even though the overwhelming evidence is indicative of the fact that you have a wild ox, you have a dead ox, and the thing that the wild ox is wild for is what killed the ox next to it, and it's standing right next to it. Nevertheless, you can't draw conclusions. You can't just assume that that's the case. We don't have evidence. And without evidence, you can't use circumstantial evidence to prove it. On the other hand, Rabbi Acha says just the opposite. The circumstantial evidence, the overwhelming circumstantial evidence, indicates that this is the one that you are going to hold liable for it. Sabrua. So the Gemara says, let us assume. So you know, as soon as the Gemara says, let us assume, the way to get out of the problem is to not make the assumption. But right now, the Gemara says, let us assume, deruva v'chazaka ki'adad eininhu. Rov and chazaka are of equal weighting over here. So even though the machloket here between the Tanna Kamma and Rabbi Acha really involves a chazaka, the chazaka is that this animal is mukzak in the case of the Tanakama to be a mu'ad gicha or the mu'ad lishoch. It's mu'ad for negichot or it's mu'ad to bite. For Rabbi Acha, the animal is not mukzak in the sense of mu'ad, but it's mukzak in the sense that it's wild and it's acting wild. That happens to be the chiddush of Rabbi Acha, that he mentions gamal, he mentions a camel and not an ox, because he's saying even in a case where the animal has no previous track record of doing things that are wrong or are goring, nevertheless, since it's wild now, we will assume that that is the animal that perpetrated the crime. So given that, the machlokah between them is, does chazakah matter? Does the chazakah of the fact that this animal has either a previous track record or is acting wild, is that enough to pin the crime on that animal? So now the Gemara says, just like there's a machloket about whether chazakah governs, there's also a machloket as to whether rov governs. And they two will be equivalent. And the truth is that over here, the chazakah is really using a rov. The chazakah is saying that since this animal has either a previous track record or this animal is acting wild, then the likely probability is that that animal did the killing or is the one that killed the animal next to it. So in that sense, the chazakah is really speaking to a probability. And so in this case, the chazakah and the rov are very similar in nature, which is that they're both looking at the probability of an outcome in these circumstances, because they're looking at rov. The chazakah just says here, I have a status quo with regards to an animal. That status quo makes us think that the probabilities are high that that animal did whatever it was that happened over here. And so too by rov, by Rabbi Shmuel, they're arguing about when you have a rov, do we assume that those probabilities are going to govern? So the Gemara says, if we equate those two here, then the machloka between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Acha would also be the machloka between Rav and Shmuel. Lema Rav, Damark Rabbi Acha. Rav holds like Rabbi Acha, just like Rabbi Acha over here says that the wild animal, we're going to pin the crime on him. So too, by rove, whenever you have a majority, the majority will govern. Ushmuel Damark Tanakhama. And Shmuel will say, it doesn't matter unless you have evidence. Just because you have a chazak or just because you have a rov is not enough reason to implicate someone. Amar lecha Rav, ana d'amre afilu d'tanakama. My response that Rav could say, I can even hold like the tanakama. Ada kan lo ka'amar tanakama hotam, elo d'lo azlinen batar chazaka. There, the tanakama says that I don't follow a chazaka. Aval batar ruba azlinen. When it comes to rov, I will. So again, the assumption of the Gemara was that rov and chazakah are equal. But Rav is saying in the end of this, it's just not true. By chazakah, I'm not going to accept it. Rov, then that would be a governing principle. Or in other words, what the Rashbam says in the Shita of Rav is that the ruba adif me chazakah. That ruba is better than a chazakah. A chazakah gives you a certain amount of information. Rov gives you a certain amount of information. Which is a better mechanism for decision. And so what Rav is saying is that rov is better quality information than chazakah. So even though the Tanakhama might say chazakah will not help me to come to a conclusion, nevertheless, rov will help me come to a conclusion. And then Shmuel is going to say the opposite. Shmuel amrecha, ana damre afilu Rabbi Acha. I'll hold like Rabbi Acha. Ad kan lo kama Rabbi Acha otam elu dazlin em butar chazakah. Dehu gufe mukzak. Over there, we're going to follow the chazakah because the animal itself is the one that has been tagged with the chazakah. Aval, but when you're talking about generically, bataruba lo azlinan. When it comes to going after the rov, we won't follow the rov. Or in essence, there is a difference between a chazakah, which is standing in front of us, information by which we know that this particular animal has a certain character trait and is acting in a manner that would make us suspicious of the animal versus when you're talking about a statistical probability about all cows in the world. When you're talking about all oxen in the world, all animals in the world, this is what you would assume. That rove is not going to be meaningful. When you're talking about this particular animal, which is acting out of line and has done all of these things, then already there's more evidence of the difference. And the way that the Rishbam terms it is, it's a difference between ruba de'ita kaman and ruba de'leita kaman. It's the difference between a rove that's in front of us versus a rove that is not in front of us. Or the way that we termed it or described it yesterday, it's the difference between a rove that is using statistical probability, which is leita de kaman, It's an assumption about what is the general outcome in these circumstances, or what is the probabilities of these happening in general, versus Ruba Deita Kaman, which is that we can look right in front of us and we have information that is meaningful, like we discussed yesterday with regards to the Dayanim in a court case. The Dayanim is a Ruba Deita Kaman. We can see the vote and the majority there. That might be different than talking about Rove by Mamon, which is a statistical probability. So that's how the Rashbam differentiates. You don't have to necessarily differentiate in that way. You could just say that what he's suggesting over here is that Chazaka is stronger than Rove, the opposite of what Rav said before. But obviously the Rashbam in doing that opens up the possibility to explain Shmuel in cases where we do need Rove to work, and that he will say, or will describe this as Rove Vita Kaman. Those are Rove that are in front of us, and therefore there might be a difference. Given that, the Gemara says you can't prove anything from this Machloka Tanaim with regards to Rav and Shmuel, because Rav and Shmuel can insert their position into either one of these Tanaim's positions. The Gemara continues and says, Tashma, Amucher peirot l'chaveiro, v'zaran v'lo tzamchu. Person buys peirot from his friend, plants them, and they don't grow. Vafilu zera pishtan, even if he buys flax seed, eno chayav b'achriyutan, he is not responsible for their not growing. This is a quote from our Mishnah. The reason that this whole sugya is found here is because our Mishnah is a question on this position, because our Mishnah involves a rove. My afilu, what is the afilu that is mentioned in the Mishnah? Vafilu zera pishtan. The Mishnah gives you a starting position, which is a mocher peirot stam. Someone who sells peirot without any indication as to what they'll be used for. And he's not warranting that they have a particular purpose. And then the individual goes and uses them for seeds and they don't grow. He's not responsible because he never warranted that they were going to be good seeds. But then it says, afilu zera pishtan. What does the Mishnah mean that even flax seed? Lav afilu zera pishtan deruba lezriya zavnei. The indication or implications of the Mishnah are that even flaxseed, which on the majority is used for seeding, nevertheless, the individual sold it to him is not responsible because there are a minority of people who do not use it for seeding. And therefore, you can just say, I thought you were amongst that minority and I did not warranty it as a seed. And therefore, I am not responsible for it. That would be a question on Rav's position. Because now you have a rove in the Mishnah, but the rove is not governing over here. Even though the majority of people use it for seeding, nevertheless, the seller is not responsible to warranty it that it actually will grow. That would be against the position of Rav. Now, the truth is, the Gemara is going to offer an answer, an explanation in the upcoming Braita, which it could have used to explain the Mishnah. So just keep that in mind, because the Rashbam asks, why doesn't the Gemara just answer the same thing it's about to answer on this question from the Mishnah? Tanaehi. Gemara says it is actually a machloket Tanaim. The Tanya. Hamocher peirot l'chaveiro v'zara'an v'lo tzamchu. He planted these peirot, the seeds from these peirot, and they did not grow. Zaronei gina she'ein ne'achalim. He planted zaronei gina that do not get eaten, meaning that their only purpose is for seeding. Chayav ba'achriyutan. Then he is responsible for replacing them. Zera pishtan, enu chayav ba'achriyutan. But if it was zera pishtan, then you're not responsible for them. The Rashbam points out over here that he thinks that the girsa in his braita is incorrect in our Gemara. It should not start out, hamocher peirot l'chaveiro, b'zaran v'lo tzamcho, because then the braita goes through zarenei gina, and then zera pishtan. It's not talking about generically. It would be the equivalent of saying, Amocher peirot l'chaveiro v'zaran v'lo tzamchu, colon. So now, what's the din? If they are zarenei gina, then you're chayav b'achriyutan. If they are zera pishtan, you're not chayav b'achriyutan. So the Rashbam says he found the Tosefta, and he thinks that that whole introductory phase is unnecessary and shouldn't be in the Braita. If you do have it in the Braita like we do, you'd have to say that it's a header with a colon. And then the Tanakhama says that if you know for certain that these are the only purpose of these seeds is for planting, then if they don't grow, the seller is responsible. But if it's zera pishtan, where the majority of individuals use it for seeding, then the mocher, the seller, is off the hook because he didn't warranty it, and it's a possibility that he bought it not for seeding, even though a majority of people would buy it for seeding. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Notein lo demei zera. Yossi says he's got to pay for the seeds. Amru lo. So they said to him, harbe lochim oto ledvarim acherim. Many people take it or buy it for other purposes. So now you have, the way that the Gemara is going to explain it over here, is that there are three opinions in the Braita. The Braita opens with the Tanakama's position, then you have Rabbi Yossi's position, and then you have somebody speaking to Rabbi Yossi, which is Amrulo, Harbe Luchim Oto L'Dvarim Acherim. Many people buy it for other purposes. You could have suggested that the Amrulo over here is actually the Tanakama speaking to Rabbi Yossi, and then there would only be two positions. So the Ramban says that that can't be the case, because the Tanakama made his position clear, which is that if it is Zerini Ginash in a Nechalim, Chayav Be'achriyutan, period. He is responsible for them. Zerapishtan, you are not responsible for them. And so now, the Amrulo are coming along and saying, well, there are many people who buy it for other things. Well, the Tanakama already made his position explicit. He wouldn't need to say that to Rabbi Yossi, because we would know that from his position from before. And why would it be a filu Zerapishtan? Zerapishtan would be obvious that you don't have to pay for it, because the rova people do not use it for seeding. So therefore, the Ramban believes that this is a third position over here. And the Rashbam, like we noted before, who had a different girsa in this Braita, quotes from the Tosefta that the only statement of the Tanakama was that Zerene Gina She'ina Chalim, that Zerene Gina that are not eaten, that you are Chayav for. And therefore, the implication or the inference from that is clear now, because he makes no statement about Zerapishtan. And therefore, the Amrulo in the Braita obviously is a differing opinion. He just suggests that there's a machloket Tanaim over here that's reflective of the machloket between Rav and Shmuel. Man Tanae. Who is the machloket Tanaim? Ilema Rabbi Yossi. If you say that it's Rabbi Yossi v'Amrulo, it's the two latter opinions in the Braita. Tavayu bataruba azle. They both believe that you go after the Rov. Mar azil bataruba de inche. One of them goes after the majority of individuals. Umar azil bataruba dizriya. And the other one goes after the majority of planters or plantings. So the difference between them is that they both agree that Rov governs. And that means that it's like Rav, which is that Rov governs. So there's no machloka between them as to whether you follow the Rov. The only question is, which Rov do you follow? Rabbi Yossi says you go after the majority of what these seeds are used for. If people buy flax seed, the volumetrically, quantitatively, the number of seeds or flax seeds that are bought, the majority is used for seeding. If I counted up any time somebody bought seeds of pishtan, and then I looked at it, a la rove, those seeds are used for planting. And then what the Amrulo say is you're looking at the wrong rove. You're looking at the seeds. I'm looking at the buyers. So if you have one buyer who comes along and buys a huge quantity of seeds, and then he's going to plant them, he will skew the rove, which is that the quantity of seeds that are bought, the rove are used for seeding. But if I look at it on an individual basis by the number of purchasers, then there could be one guy who comes in and buys a small amount of seed for oil, another guy who comes in and buys a small amount of seed for some other purpose, and then another guy who comes and buys a huge quantity of seeds for planting. I have three individuals out of here. Two out of those three individuals bought it for non-seeding purposes. That means the majority of people didn't buy it for seeding, even though the majority of seeds were bought for seeding. So that's their machloket according to this. Machloket between Rabbi Yossi and the Amrulo is which majority should govern. Is it the majority of flax seeds that are purchased? That's how we should determine it. That's Rabbi Yossi's opinion. Or is it the majority of purchasers? What are they purchasing for? Irrespective of the quantity that they purchase, what do they buy it for? And that's what he thinks is governing. In both cases, they think that the rove is what determines in the case. Now, this is where the Rashbam says, you could have answered the same thing for our Mishnah. We question Rav from our Mishnah, and it says, oh, there's flax seed in the Mishnah. And the Mishnah says that even though the majority of people use flax seed for planting, nevertheless, you're not responsible for it. So that's a question on Rav. You know what Rav could have answered? You're looking at the wrong rove. You're looking at rove of seeds. Tana of the Mishnah holds like the Amrulo, and you look at the majority of purchasers and not the majority of seeds. In that case, Rav could get out of the problem and say that the Rov in the Mishnah does not weigh in the case because the Rov actually favors not having to pay versus having to pay. So the Rishbam says, why didn't the Gemara just answer that on behalf of Rav in the Mishnah? Instead of going on and saying, oh, you know what? It seems like that's a question of Rav, and then we have to find that it's a Machloket Tanaim. Why don't we just answer on Rav's behalf? So he says that, Dim ita deruba de inche chashuv Rov, deruba de zriya kamandalete, lo havele de mitne afilu. He says the word afilu causes the problem. The word afilu means that this Zerapishtan is different than the statement before. The statement before was peirot stam, regular fruits. Then it says afilu, even flaxseed. That comes to imply that flaxseed, there's more a likelihood that you would not think you are responsible, and despite the fact you are responsible. If you explain the Mishnah as a case where you go after the majority of purchasers over there, then majority of people don't use it for seeding. Why would it be afilu Zerapishtan? Zerapishtan would be obvious that you don't have to pay for it because the rove of people do not use it for seeding. So if that's the way you're going to explain the Mishnah, the word afilu is misplaced. The word afilu comes to indicate, despite the fact that there's mitigating circumstances, the din is still that way. So now, given that, the word afilu makes it obvious that that's not the explanation of the Mishnah. Then he does say afterwards, miu, imlo mipnei shimotzei tanaim deplige berabu Shmuel. Had the Gemara not found a machloket tanaim that then can be that Rav follows a Tana, that is not the Tana of our Mishnah, the Gemara avalei lishnuya deyadchak, then the Gemara would be pinned into a corner and use this answer. So the Rishbam says, Enochanami, if the Gemara had no choice, it would have used this answer. But now that it has a choice to say that Rav just holds like a different Tana, it much preferred to do that because then it doesn't need to create this difficult explanation in the Mishnah that uses the word afilu, and we can just say it's a machloket tanaim rather than trying to make the Mishnah in some acrobatic way fit into the position of Rav. So the Rishbam in the end says, Enochanami could have answered that, but it's not the simplest answer, and therefore the Gemara leans towards saying that it is a machloket tanaim. But that's what we're searching for over here. What is the machloket tanaim? Ella, the Gemara's answer is, Itanakama virabi Yosi, Itanakama viamrulo. So what the Gemara answers in the end is that both the Amru Lo and Rabbi Yossi believe that Rov governs. So the Machloket Tanaim is between the Tanakama who says that Rov does not govern, because he says you're not responsible when you sell Zerapishtan, and therefore he is arguing on this position of Rov. So then he has either the Tanakama versus Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi says Rov does govern, the Tanakama says it doesn't, or it's the Tanakama versus the Amru Lo. Even though the Amru Lo and the Tanakama have the same din over here, they have it for different reasons. The Tanakama believes that over here you're not responsible for the flax seeds because Rov doesn't govern. On the other hand, the Amru Lo say that Rov does govern, but you're looking at the wrong Rov. And for that reason that the Zerapishtan you're not responsible for. But that means underlying that there is a machloket as to whether Rov matters. Tanakama says Rov does not matter, and the Amru Lo say that Rov does matter. So now the Gemara been inconclusive, at least from Tanaic positions, as to whether Rav and Shmuel is correct. In the end, the Gemara concludes that there is a machloket Tanaim that reflects that same machloket between Rav and Shmuel. And so they were left in the same position, which is Rav believes Rov governs, so does Rabbi Yossi, so does the Amru Lo in this Braita that we brought. And Shmuel believes that Rov does not govern, just like the Tana of our Mishnah, and just like the Tanakama of the Braita. So we have a machlok between Rav and Shmuel, which we now just showed is also a machlok at Tanaim, but we can't bring any proofs from any Tanaic works that would indicate either like Shmuel or Rav definitively. And the truth is now that we have a braita that shows that it is a machlok at Tanaim, then whatever you showed from any Tanaic work would not be meaningful because you always can say, I hold like the other Tana. As long as I have a Tana supporting my position, then I can even argue on a Tana or Tanaic work, because I have a Tana who backs me up. So at this point, we're left in a position where we don't know what the halacha is. It's the halacha like Rav or Shmuel, and therefore we'll have to default to the ways of determining when we have machloket Rav and Shmuel, as whether the halacha is like Rav or Shmuel, and that is be'isurei halacha k'Rav, and be'mamone halacha k'Shmuel, or be'dine halacha k'Shmuel. And therefore over here, the halacha will be like Shmuel, because this is a monetary matter. Tana banan, ma'u noteinlo. If the individual has a right of claim against the seller for the seeds, What is the compensation that he receives? Demei zera v'lo hotza'a. We have a braita that says, the Tanakhama says, that he gets back the cost of the seeds. He gets refunded on the sale. But his expenditures, he does not get reimbursed. V'yishomrim af hotza'a. There is a yishomrim, meaning that there is another Tana who believes, not only do you have to get paid for the seeds, you have to pay for his outlays. The way that the Rashbam describes it over here, Yitziat Charisha B'Schar Po'alim, he paid for it to be plowed, he worked on the plowing, he hired workers to do this. There was a large investment made in planting these seeds, and the failure of these seeds cost him not only the money of the seeds, but all the other investment he made surrounding those seeds. Now, as the Rashbam points out over here, is V'nira Be'enai D'Knosahu. I believe that this reimbursement is a fine, and not a... not a direct repayment, because, as he said before for the Tanakhama, groma ba'almahu upatur. This is clearly groma. You can't claim that the individual who gave him the seeds was the direct cause of the loss that was incurred. He might be an indirect cause of the loss. He is a groma in the cause of those losses or those expenditures, but he's not the direct responsible party. Therefore, the Tanakhama says he has to pay for the seeds, because there he's clearly responsible. The outlays are groma, and therefore he's patur. What the Yeshomrim say is, yes, it's groma, but we're going to be konesim over here. We're going to fine him over here, because we don't want people doing this, or we don't want this type of behavior in the market. And so we're going to fine him and say that despite the fact that it's groma, we're going to hold you responsible for all of the outlays. So that's the way that the Rashbam describes it. The Rabbeinu Gershom over here says that the outlays are not like the Rashbam describes over here, the outlays for plowing and workers, but rather, Shimotzil takena zera kulo chayav litein lo. He paid to fix the seeds. Whatever that means, I'm not sure what the Rabbeinu Gershom means, but it seems like he had to do something or to alter something to get the seeds to actually grow. So he had to invest additional money into the seeds in order to make them viable. So then over there, you could argue that it's not only nas. Maybe he believes that there is direct damage that was caused here, which forced you to invest in the seeds themselves in order to make them grow. Throwing it out, the possibility that according to Rabbeinu Gershom, maybe Mi'ikar Adin is Chayav according to the Yeshomrim over here, rather than it being a din of Grama. So now, the Gemara asks, Man Yeshomrim, who are the Yeshomrim over here? Now the Tanakhama in all likelihood is Rabbi Yossi, because Rabbi Yossi said in the previous Braita, Rabbi Yossi Omer, notain though, Demei Zera. So here is the opinion of Demei Zera that is mentioned in this Braita. So we're in search of the Yeshomrim as to who is the one who says that it's not only Demei Zera, but also the Hotza'ah. The Baal Yosef point out that even though the Gemara says that Yeshomrim in Shas is Rabbi Natan, nevertheless, we find places where that's not true. So he says the Gemara had a Mesorah here, that this Yeshomrim of here was not Rabbi Natan. And he shows us that there are other places, like you have Breitot, Mishnayot, where you have a Yeshomrim and Rabbi Natan in the Breitot. So it's clear there that the Yeshomrim is not Rabbi Natan. So it's not 100% of the time Yeshomrim is Rabbi Natan. But if we don't have evidence to the contrary, we will assume it's Rabbi Natan. Over here they had a Mesorah, Amar Rav Chista, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, that the Yeshomrim here was not Rabbi Natan, but rather Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Hey, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Which Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel? Rav Chista tells us that's Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Where do you find Rabbi Shimon Gamliel with that type of opinion? Ilema Rabbi Shimon Gamliel de Matnitin. If you think it's Rabbi Shimon Gamliel from our Mishnah, it's not. Our Mishnah says, Amocher Perot de Chaviro, Vizaran Velotzamchu, Evi Te Bais, Perot Stam, and he plants them and they don't grow, Vafilu Zerapishtan, Enu Chayaba Chriutan. He's not responsible, the seller is not responsible for the seeds because he didn't guarantee or warrantee that they were seeds. And since there is a possibility he bought them for eating or for something else, he's not responsible. Ema Seifa, the Seifa says, Rabbi Shimon Gomer, Zeroni Gina, if they are seeds that are only used for planting, Sheina Nechalim, and they're not eaten, Chaya Be'achriyutan, he is responsible for them. So the Gemara says, Tana Nakama, Nami Hakin Kamar. The Tanakhama doesn't disagree with Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's position. Tanakhama gave you two examples of seeds that were sold. Perot, stam, which is something that's used 50-50. And then he sold Zerah Pishtan, which is ala rov for seeding, but there's still a minority. But then you would infer from the Tanakhama's position that if it was 100% for seeding, that he would agree that that is a mekach taot. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's position and the Tanakhama's position are not are not really differentiated. He can infer from his position. Zera pishtan, flaxseed, which on the majority is used for seeding, but there still is a minority that don't. There, the seller is responsible. Ha? You would infer, zeru negina, shena nechali. You're talking about seeds that are only used for seeding. He would agree that you are responsible for replacing them. So then, what's the difference between the Tanakama and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and our Mishnah? Elalav, hotza'i kameinayu. The difference between them is whether you are responsible for the additional costs beyond the seeds themselves. Marsavar de mezera. One of them holds just the value of the seeds is what you're responsible for. Marsavar afotza. And the other one says that you are responsible not only for the seeds, but also for the additional expenses that were incurred. Mar says, mimai. How do you know that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was of the position that you're responsible for the hotel and not the Tanakama? All you showed me is that the Tanakama and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel have the same position. So that doesn't make sense. Why would two Tanaim say the exact same thing in a Mishnah? The answer is they must be saying something different. You're suggesting now that the difference is whether you're responsible for the Hotzot or not. How do you know which of the two has that opinion? You're saying to us, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, you're also Chayav Hotzot. How do you know it's not the Tanakama that makes that statement? Doma Ipchot, maybe it's just the opposite. Halukasha, that's not the case. Kotana Batra, Litzfuye Milta Galati. The latter Tana in a Mishnah, unless explicitly stated otherwise, is coming to add something on. So if you have a Mishnah or a Braita in which the two Tanaim are saying the exact same thing, and then you say, well, the difference between it must be this additional item, we always assign that addition to the latter Tana. Because it only makes sense to bring a same opinion down if you're adding something when you say the exact same thing. So we're always going to ascribe the addition to the later Tana. So over here, we're going to ascribe the person who is saying that you're chayav for more to the latter Tana. The latter Tana is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. And that's how we know it. Gemara says, V'dilma kula Rabbi Shimon Gamliel hi. Well, maybe the whole Mishnah is authored by Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. V'chasurei mechsera. And it's missing some transition words in there. V'achiktoni. And this is the way the Mishnah should read. Amucher peirot l'chavirov zara'an v'lo zomchu. You're not responsible for them in that case. Divrei Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. That is the position of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Shir Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer. Because Rabbi Shimon Gamliel tells us, Zero Gnei Gina, Shinim Nechalim, Chayav Be'achriyutan. That Zerenei Gina, things that are only used for seeding, that's where you are Chayav. So you can infer from that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel thinks only those types of seeds are you responsible for. The other seeds you are not responsible for. And then, the whole Mishnah will be one authorship of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Now, even though to say Chasurei Mechsera, to say the Mishnah's missing words, is just a strained answer as saying that they argue about this issue of Hotzah or not. So why does the Gemara all of a sudden say, okay, you know what? Let's say it's a Chasurei Mechsera instead of this. What makes you say one over the other? So the Rashbam over here says that Ein Zeh Terutz Dachuk. That's not a difficult answer. The tov lanu lechasra ma'at kederach mishnah shemedaberet v'kutzer v'lo neima yitzia ika beinayu. He says that it makes more sense to say that the Mishnah is written in shorthand, which is the literary style of the Mishnah, and therefore it makes more sense to say chasurei mechsera than to make up a machloket that doesn't exist in the Mishnah. You're adding in a factor that is not even mentioned in the Mishnah. So we're better off saying chasurei mechsera than saying that the difference between them is whether you are responsible for the yitziot or not responsible for the yitziot. Now look, if we were in a position where we couldn't say chasurei mechsera, we would say that other answer. But now that we have the option to say chasurei mechsera, which again would abide by the normal literary style of a Mishnah that it leaves out some transition words, we see that all the time. So therefore, if it's missing and we can fill them in easily and make it into a single authorship, that would be something that is more appealing than saying that they have a machloket about something that is not even mentioned in the Mishnah. So now the Gemara continues and says, they can't prove anything from our Mishnah. Ella, ha Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. It must be this Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, the Tanya from the Braita. Hamolich chitim litchom. Person takes his wheat to be milled. Velo latzatan. And the miller did not soak the grains first. By not soaking the grains, he did not cause the peel or the shell to come off of the wheat. And that means that when he mills it, he's milling it together with the shell in there. And then, vasan subin. And then he makes it into subin or mursan, which is that he makes it into subin and mursan are types of bran. One is a cereal bran and one is a more coarse bran. So they're different types of bran, but because he left the shells in there, he gave him poor quality flour. Kemach lenachtum, if he gave flour to a baker, bafo pat nipolim, and he baked for him a bread that falls apart or crumbles. Behema letabach, he gave an animal to a butcher, venivla, and in shechting it, he made it into a nevela. Chayav, in all those cases, he is responsible. The uman, the craftsman, is responsible for his professional work. Mipnei shehu kenosei sachar, because he is like a hired help. Now, the truth is that the Gemara in Baba Kama, in discussing this, amends the language to say, Sharehu nosei sachar, because he is a nosei sachar. Not ke, like, with the kafa dimyon, but rather because he is a nosei sachar. And the conclusion of the Gemara over there is that if a professional is paid, then he's responsible for his work. If he does something that is a pshia or karov the pshia, he has to reimburse the customer for doing that. On the other hand, if the craftsman, the professional, does it for free, then he is not responsible. Because he did it for free, then even though it's somewhat of a pshia, or he did something that was incorrect, nevertheless, he'll be patur in that case. So the Gemara's conclusion is that it has to do with whether you're paid or not. When you're paid, you're responsible. You're not paid, you're not responsible. The way it reads over here before they amend it is that he is like a nosei sachar, means that even if he's not paid, he'd be responsible because he is like a nosei sachar because of his professional standing. So now the Balei Tosafot want to understand, why is that the case? What's the havamina here that when you don't pay someone, that he's going to be responsible for his work? So the Balei Tosafot here mentioned something that they mentioned in Baba Kama that is not muskam to all the Rishonim. The Ramban and others argue against this position of the Balei Tosafot. But the Balei Tosafot over there say that when we say that an Adama Mazik is always Chayav, always doesn't really mean always. There are times or instances where an individual is deemed to be an Ones. It's accidental and it wasn't something that he can be held responsible for and it'll be Patur. So the Tosafot opens up this possibility that sometimes there is an Adama Mazik who's Patur because of Ones. He says, how do you know which one is which? He says, it depends. You have different types of Ones. You have an Ones that's Karov to being more of a mistake or something that was not your responsibility. You have an Ones sometimes that is more along the lines of your responsibility, Pshia. He defines them as the difference between an Aveda and Geneva. That losing something is really an onus, it was an accident, but it's an accident where we would assign more responsibility to you. Then, if you're an onus where you have a gneva, it was stolen from you, there was theft, again, there, it's an accident, you should be responsible to make sure it didn't get stolen, but there it's more out of your control than the case of a veda. So therefore he says, in a spectrum of onus, you would have to differentiate in that manner, which is Oneh sakarov lepshia kein aveda, similar to an aveda, v'adama mazik chayav, and therefore an adama mazik is going to be chayav. V'hava sakadatcha, we would have thought, tabach uman shikilkel, if you have a butcher who mistakenly makes it into an avela while he's shechting it, kein aveda. It's similar to a case of aveda, v'chayav. And even though it was an accident, it wasn't done intentionally, nevertheless, it's an accident that's kioter krov lepshia, and you'd be chayav. Kamo nosei sachar, similar to a nosei sachar, like a shomer sachar. Umishane, and the Gemara answers, Eima mipnei shehu nosei sachar. Now the answer is in the end that only if he gets paid is he responsible. Aval b'chinam patur, but if he does it for free is patur. Vavi ke'ein gneva. It's more similar than to theft, shekrova l'ones, which is much closer ones, upatur ba'adama mazik. And therefore the adama mazik is patur. So this is Tosafot l'shitoto, that there is a difference in Adama Mazik between whether he is more karov the pshia, even though it was an accident, where he will be responsible, like the Gemara states, Adama Mazik is always chayav, versus a case where the Adama Mazik is an ones, but he is yoter karov to being like Geneva, where it's really an accident and he really lacks responsibility, and there he'd be patur. And those who bring examples from the Gemara in Baba Kama on Daf Pei Bet, and other areas where we see that Adama Mazik is still considered to be Patur. The Ramban argues on that position. He thinks that Adama Mazik is always Chayav. He's never off the hook when it comes to Ones. And then you have to give alternate explanations as to why in certain circumstances We give him a tour. It's not because Adam HaMazik is patur, but rather that the circumstances make it that he's no longer classified as Adam HaMazik. And that's how the Ramban answered that. But just you should know that this is Tosfot Deshitato trying to explain, but why would a professional be chayav when he's not getting paid? The answer is that we would deem him to be as if he is close to being a pusheya, even though it was an accident, but in his professionalism, those types of accidents shouldn't happen. And therefore we would hold him responsible. The conclusion of the Gemara is, no. Only if he gets paid is he chayav, and that's because he is a shomer sachar. But that means if he did it for free, is patur, because then we deem the accident to be really closer to being an ones, meaning something that is really out of his control than being in his control, and that's why he'd be patur. Shmuel Gamliel says that not only is he chayav because he's a nosei sachar, which means that he's responsible for that which happened, he's also responsible for the embarrassment the individual underwent and the embarrassment of his guests. So for instance, in this case where he gave him flour to bake him bread, and now he goes to serve the bread at the meal with these guests that are over there, he's embarrassed by the fact that he has this bread that's crumbling and it's not good. And the guests are embarrassed that they're in a position where they're eating or they're in a meal where the food being served to them is not up to snuff or is not meeting with their standards or their status. So what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says is you're chayav not only for the direct damage that you did, but even for the indirect damage that you did. And that would be supportive of what Rav Chisda said, that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is the Yesh Omrim in the Braita that we brought, that you're not only chayav for the direct damage, you're also chayav for the indirect damage over here. And as the Rashbam points out, it's a kal v'chomer. Over here, Demei Boshet is an intangible item. It's not a monetary loss. It is a feeling, an experience by the individual that we want you to compensate him from. Kol Shekein over here, where there was real monetary loss that he expended money, there, of course, you would be responsible. Nevertheless, what the Rashbam says in the end, Miha, Late Hilchot Ha'elikir Rabbonon, the Patre Mi Boshet. Despite the fact that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says it, the Loch is like the Chachamim that say you are Patur, the Gromahu, because it is a Groma. Now, wait a minute, we just set up our Mishnah as being a possible Machloke between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. And we have a principle in Shas that halachic Rabbi Shimon Gamliel be Mishnatenu. Anytime Rabbi Shimon Gamliel appears in the Mishnah, the halacha is like it. If you say that our Mishnah is a machloke between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel as to whether you have to pay not only for the seeds, but even for the hotza'ah, that means that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in our Mishnah believes that that is the halacha. Not just in the Braita, but even in our Mishnah. Once we've established the Braita as saying that that is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's opinion, then you no longer have to say Chasurei Mechzer in the Mishnah in the Enoch Hanami. Shimon Gamliel's position in our Mishnah, arguing the Tanakhama, will be exactly that. Shimon Gamliel believes you have to pay not only for the direct damage, you have to pay for the indirect damage. If he's found in our Mishnah, the Lacha should be like him. What the Rashbam says is, that's not compelling. Just because that's the machlok between the Tanakhama and the Chachamim and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in this Braita, doesn't mean then that you have to say the machlokin in our Mishnah is about that same factor. It might be that our Mishnah is Chasurei Mechzera, and the whole Mishnah is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. And therefore then there is no machloket about whether Yitziah or not Yitziah. Shimon is the author of a Mishnah, irrespective of the Yitziah issue. And given that, then you can't say, Halacha Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Mishnatenu, because in our Mishnah he has nothing to do with this issue of payments beyond the direct damage. So that's why the Rashbam over here says, Halacha is not like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, despite his appearance in our Mishnah, because our Mishnah can be explained differently than the Braita, without the issue of the Braita. And given that, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, our Mishnah may not be talking about Yitziah at all. And therefore, the Halacha is not like him. Now, Merz says, V'chein ayah Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Minag gadol ayah b'Yerushalayim. These were the practices or customs of the people in Yerushalayim. Minag gadol ayah b'Yerushalayim, Moser suda l'chaveiro v'kilkala. Someone who gives over a suda to his friend, meaning that he is catering the meal, v'kilkala, and he messed it up. Notein lo d'mei boshto d'mei boshet ochav. So here you see again, there's this idea. He gave him meals to serve his guests, or he gave him the raw materials to cook and cater the meal, whatever it was that he gave to him, and he ruined it, and now he doesn't have what to serve his guests, or whatever he's serving his guests is substandard. So again, that's similar to what you saw with the Patni Poldim. They forced him to pay, not only for the direct damage, but even the indirect damage. Od minag gadol ayah b'Yerushalayim. Another minag that they had with regards to Orchim. Now, the reason that he's adding this in is because the way that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says it is that you're responsible not only for the monetary loss that he incurred, but also for the embarrassment. The reason you're chayav for the embarrassment is because the people of Yerushalayim put such a premium on hachnasat orchim. And here you embarrassed him. How do I know, or how can I show you that they put a premium on hachnasat orchim? Because they had these other practices, which are the following. That when the handkerchief was hanging on the doorway, or the napkin was hanging on the doorway, as long as the mapa is there, people came in. When they took the napkin away, then the guests no longer enter. What is happening here is similar to the circumstance in Eretz Yisrael, which is that in many weddings, they don't expect a response. They send out an invitation, and they don't expect a response, so they never know how many people are going to show up. They have to cater based on a guesstimate of how many people are going to show up. So this guy has the same thing. He put out these invitations. He doesn't know who's going to show up. But he also knows that he has a limited amount of food and limited amount of spaces. So how does it work? He puts a napkin or a handkerchief on the door. That way the guests know as long as that is still there, there's room in the meal for them to come to join. Once it's taken off, there's no longer room there. And then they won't come in expecting to eat. And they won't embarrass him by coming then, and he doesn't have enough food or enough space for them. So that was a way to signal to the people when he had reached his capacity in terms of guests. Now, in other places, when it brings it down, notes that some of these people still entered to wish him a mazel tov, but they knew that they weren't going to stay to eat anymore. It was a way to indicate that the space for guests who were going to eat was already used up. So again, it's an indication of how they put a premium on proper etiquette and achnasat orchim in Yerushalayim not to embarrass individuals. Next Mishnah, Mocher Perot Techaveiro, Varizeh Mikabel Alav Rova Tinofet Lisa'a. An individual who buys fruits, then he expects that there's going to be a quarter kav worth of tinofet for every sa'ah. If you remember, there are six kav in a sa'ah. If you're talking about a quarter kav, you're talking about 1/24 of the quantity or the volume that you buy, you expect to be tinofet. So here, tinofet could be either refuse, dirt, rocks, pebbles, or it could be other produce or other fruits that are being processed in the same area. But either way, it's considered to be an acceptable volume that people would expect to find when they buy a sa'ah's worth, that 1/24 of it would contain these either other items or psolet in it. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom describes it over here, he says, is that if you have 1/24 of that mixture of afrurit and dirt inside of it, then we say that it happened passively, which is that in the processing of the items, that got mixed in there. If it is more than 1/24, then we suspect that the individual actually mixed it in order to cheat on the volumes or reduce the amount that he has to put in order to sell these volumes. So Rabbeinu Gershom sees the 1/24 threshold as being the difference between whether it happened just through the process or whether it was intentionally done. Versus the others that just say that this is the minhag of the places, and therefore the people are mochel on those volumes. That leads to a machloket in the Gonim Rishonim as to whether our Mishnah is just stating that this is the minhag in these particular places, and if you have minhagim in other places, then that would govern. This Mishnah is speaking about a specific place, and it's not telling you what the default is. Every area will have to come up with what their default is. Or is this saying that this is the standard when there is no other minhag? This will be the default standard. And if you have a separate minhag in that place, then that minhag will govern. But otherwise, this will govern. Te'inim, when it comes to figs, mikabel alav eser metulaot tameya. He takes a 10% loss, meaning that he expects that 10% of the figs will contain worms or pests inside of them. And it's 10%. It doesn't have to be 100. If he buys 10, he'd expect one of them to have that condition. But that is an acceptable amount of rot or problematic figs in a purchase of figs. Martev shel yayin, in a cellar of wine, mikabel alav eser kosusot lemeya. He accepts 10 bad quality barrels of wine for every 100, or again, a 10% loss factor. We assume that 10% of the wine here is either going to turn into vinegar or is going to be bad quality wine. Kankanim bisharon, when you buy pitchers in the Sharon, along the coastline of Eretz Yisrael, mikabel alav eser pitasot meya. Then he accepts 10 faulty ones for every 100 or 10% loss factor. But here it has to be that the pitchers are functional, but they have some sort of either deformity associated with them, or they might have a crack in them that make them not as useful. It has to be that they do function, otherwise then he sold them something that's completely irrelevant, and he can't expect to get paid for it. But the assumption of at least 10 bad quality pitchers among 100, that's acceptable. Remember, everything's handmade in those days. So if you have 100 barrels that are handmade, either because of the quality of the material, the way that it was fired in the kiln, or there is a natural cracking of the materials, it will come out that 10% of them will have some fault in them, and that is to be expected, and that is within the realm of reason if someone purchases. Somebody says, Atani Rav Katina. Rav Katina says, Rova kitnit lisa, vafarit lo. It's acceptable to have a rova worth of legumes subsumed in this quantity, but dirt is not acceptable. So Rav Katina over here establishes that it's considered to be a fair practice that you have other items, other types of, whether it's legumes inside of the grain, things that are grown nearby or processed nearby, it's acceptable for that to get mixed up because they were in the silo together. But to add in dirt, which is completely worthless, that is not an acceptable amount, even at the levels of 1/24th. The Gemara in tomorrow's daf is going to question whether that's really true, because we find instances where it seems to be that it is acceptable to have stones, pebbles, dirt inside of the items that are sold, and they are considered to be the natural part of the volume that is sold and not a problem, unlike this position of Rav Katina. And therefore, we're going to have to re-examine this position of Rav Katina in order to reconcile it with those other positions or Tanaic works that we have. Okay, we're going to stop here. Two lines from the bottom of Tzadik Gimel Amud Bet.